بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم. الحمد لله رب العالمين، والصلاة والسلام على أشرف الأنبياء والمرسلين سيدنا محمد وعلى آله وصحبه أجمعين. So welcome to the second of these somewhat domestic lectures on my topic of seclusion and love. And it's as we move into the middle third of Ramadan, the time of Maghfirah, it's good to see the response that CMC has had in this offering that it has for the Ummah, this lockdown Ramadan, of a lot of lectures from our key staff for free. So alhamdulillah, and we'll be announcing something, I think, on social media later this week about a special feature which will feature some of your feedback and requests so that this becomes properly interactive. The topic of uzla wa mahabba, we've already seen, is quite central to religion and rather indicative, particularly of the specific quality of Islamic or Ishmaelite religion, that particular Ismaili way of being Abrahamic. And we reflected last time on some of the implications of this and of Islam's corrective role historically. We know the famous doctrine of cyclical revelation, which is part of our teaching. Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala sends a messenger, heals humanity, sets them right, islah is accomplished, and then as the generations move by, things start to deteriorate through a kind of process of natural entropy. Human beings get forgetful as well as nostalgic, and it may come to pass that a new religious dispensation is required and a new book revealed. And we saw that the specific timing of the arrival of Islam was related to the decline of Ahlul Kitab, and particularly the Nasara, insofar as a very strongly world-denying movement had grown up. And obviously the reasons for the arrival of the new dispensation were more than that, and were to do with the need for the fullness of revelation in the form of the Qur'an to be gifted to mankind, and also to do with certain doctrinal complexities that were actually tearing the Middle East apart, largely to do with the dual nature of Christ, the Trinity. Issues that were costing millions of lives. And so Islam comes with the clear sword of Tawheed. It cuts through all of that and just restores people to the ibadah of the one God. So a reparative mission, and the function of the prophets essentially is just to help people, to make things easier. And the Holy Prophet said, "Innama bu'ithtu muyassira," I've just been sent to make things easier for people. And then we looked at the question of whether actually we can know what we need to know as spiritual, pneumatic human beings without access to a revelation, to a prophet. To what extent can we work it out through a kind of analogy or deduction, a natural theology from the world? And we saw this rather charming story of Alive, son of Awake, Hay ibn Yaqzan, the idea being that this youth brought up in the beauty and grandeur and splendor of nature with wild animals to help him, would end up with a full set of particulars about the nature of life and the existence of the Creator. And we saw the influence that story has had, being really at the fountainhead of the English novel, which is, I guess, the greatest novel. It's greater than the German or the French novel, with Defoe, that there's an Islamic intervention there. And this has to do with the waves of love, which I ended by talking about, which we'll be looking at a little bit more carefully, inshallah, next time. But you probably went away from that thinking, well, it's a very pretty story, but would it really be like that? What would be the fate of a baby washed up on a desert island? And this really gets to the essence of what we're talking about in these lectures. What is the due balance between solitude and seclusion on the one hand and rubbing shoulders with our fellow humans on the other? Now, the reality is, of course, that there have been, in the complexities and the tragedies of human history, plenty of cases of children left to their own devices, of feral children. And if you look them up, you'll see that in every case it entails a tragedy. Feral children, the famous wolf children of Hesse in central Germany in the Middle Ages, supposedly brought up by wolves, rather like Romulus and Remus, the legendary founders of ancient Rome, who were suckled by a she-wolf. It's a very ancient story and thought. And then a range of others, and even in modern times, the tragic story of somebody called Oksana Malaya, who was from Ukraine only a few years ago, whose parents were both extreme alcoholics, who just left this little girl from a very early age, basically to hang out with the family dogs. And she obviously grew up socialized by the dogs, and when she was finally taken into care, 10 years or so later, she barked and she walked on all fours. And even today, as an adult, she finds it very difficult to speak and to engage normally. And you could think of many examples, and it is commonsensical because we need to be socialized, and that's really what tarbiyah and what childhood is about. It's not about the absorbance of information primarily, but about knowing how to engage with other human beings. And this has been confirmed by a lot of studies, because the modern world as well as the pre-modern world is interested in this idea of the autodidact. To what extent can we learn without others? So the famous, or some would say notorious, Professor Harry Harlow at the University of Madison, Wisconsin, earned a rather dark reputation for himself in the middle of the 20th century. He himself was a rather depressive person after the death of his wife, and basically he had a lab in which he experimented with parental deprivation on primates. So these are basically rhesus monkeys plunged into seclusion, Osler, from their very earliest days in a horrible device that he called the Pit of Despair, which was a kind of metal box, very uncomfortable, in which these poor baby monkeys would be brought up. And of course, when they became mature, they were completely and permanently dysfunctional. So if they had babies, they would eat their babies, that kind of thing, just horrendous. Experience, and whether the experiment's really necessary when it's fairly obvious that we do need socialization, that we do need parenting, is a good question. So, as well as solitude, which actually sometimes can be good for us, sometimes we need to get away from things in order to write that paper and to revise for exams and to pray. That aspect of Oslo, there is also loneliness. That's another thing that we need to think about. There's a distinction between solitude and loneliness. You might say in the Islamic terminology, wahda and wahsha. Wahda is being alone. Wahsha is being desolated by solitude, really suffering from it. And it is a very real source of medical harm, physical as well as mental harm. It's one of the harshest things that you can do to a human being, like that poor Ukrainian child, this washa, which in the Arabic language has the sense of kind of being reduced to animal status and to lose all of the finer feelings. So the dopamine receptors are hit. There's less sort of pleasure hormone in the system. There's a lot of cortisol released when we're feeling really chronically alone. And there's negative health impacts, and clinically it's demonstrated that loneliness is a major factor in stroke and in heart disease and in dementia, high blood pressure, a whole lot of things, as well as mental health issues as well. So the notorious supermax prisons in America, where you're kept completely isolated from any human contact for 23 hours a day, and even for that remaining hour, everything is very kind of formal and cold and limited and rather inhuman. The UN investigated the American supermax prisons and said that it was a fundamental inhuman and degrading principle. But that, of course, fell on deaf ears, and there are tens of thousands of people being subject to that kind of solitary confinement, a particularly cruel thing. And loneliness also is a major cause for suicide amongst the young. So in our individualistic and atomistic world, where we're told to be individuals, to be ourselves, where the basic social unit is the individual, the free sovereign person, released and liberated by the Enlightenment rather than the family or the church or the congregation or the tribe or whatever it might be, but the individual, society made up of individuals. So Lady Thatcher famously said, there's no such thing as society. And they've done a lot in the last 20 or 30 neoliberal years to break down the structures of social care and the infrastructure that society really needs for proper sociality. And the result has been an epidemic of loneliness. So not solitude, that Osler, that Wahda, but loneliness, Washa, as really one of the great epidemics of our time. So the UN now has a campaign to end loneliness. How are they going to do it? It's not very clear. In the UK, we now have the world's first Minister of Loneliness. This is Baroness Barron, who's been wheeled out. We have a lot of, there's a proliferation of ministries now, and this is one of the latest ones. How to make people less lonely, when it's equivalent, worse than being obese, it's worse than smoking 15 cigarettes a day. It's regarded as a public health crisis. It's an epidemic, probably kills more people than the coronavirus. But it's caused by the fact that our society is disrupted, and that as well as occasional solitude, which is a good and a healthy thing, there is this loneliness, which is not a good and a healthy thing, but in fact a real form of cruelty. George Monbiot, the environmental campaigner and columnist, says that future generations, if there are future generations after the climate catastrophe, will call our age the age of loneliness because it's so widespread and cities are full of people, but they're not really engaging with their neighbours. Families are not really properly engaging the way they did. The dinner table is abandoned. More than half of families in England, according to the Daily Telegraph recently, have a family meal together less than once a week. It's fragmented. Even on the most sort of fundamental nuclear family basis, ours is a society of individuals that is falling apart, which of course raises interesting questions, and I talk about this in my new book, for the requirement that Muslims integrate. There should be social cohesion. We should integrate into wider society. We should participate in society's shared values, etc., etc. Every government has to say this in order to please the right-wing xenophobic lobbies. Muslims need to integrate, so do the Orthodox Jews and other communities. Plymouth Brethren, who are separate, quite innocuous communities, usually with very high degrees of integration and sociality, a sohba amongst themselves, but they're being barked at regularly and told to integrate, but into a society that is disintegrating. So we integrate into something that is disintegrating, where the old people are kind of locked away in care homes, where young people are increasingly basically socialized by school and even nourished and fed at school because of the disastrous consequences of the collapse of traditional values. And it's not clear where this is going to go, but the human beings, as Monbiot said, are designed as pack animals. The human bee, he calls us. We're supposed to live in hives, to hum together, to make honey. We're not really supposed to be a society of lots of little atoms moving around in a kind of Brownian motion. This is horrible. And one of the features of modernity that really is of concern to religious people is this enlightenment freeing up of the human individual, turning into a society that isn't really society any longer. I live in a village, the post office is closed, the church has a diminishing congregation, even the telephone box is now disconnected. There's no shop. And this is normal. So where there was a local infrastructure and places for neighbours to engage and to chat and families to get together, even a generation ago, there's hardly anything. And loneliness can be quite acute in rural areas. And this is to do with the decline of religion more than anything else. Religion provides us with the best congregation and the best reason to congregate. There's really no substitute for a church community or a mosque community or a synagogue. The pub can't really supply for that because the pub is not going to organise a women's institute and go out to help refugees and the poor of the parish and have a Sunday school. The pub is just a pub. It may seem to be a centre for sociality and a place where loneliness can be fought, but it doesn't really have the benign social impact that a place of worship is going to have. So as we move forwards in our increasingly fragmented Western societies, and we're invited to integrate, we have to bear this in mind. Integrating into what? Do your neighbours really want to know your name, even? Do they want to get involved in your life? Isn't it easier just to sit in bed and text somebody in Singapore? This is the reality, the way in which we're going. And I think that in terms of making our Islam functional in the West and explaining it, we have to bear this in mind. The Sharia and the Sunnah and our akhlaq are designed for a healthy kind of society where people are properly engaging with each other, where the family and the extended family are a reality, where neighbours know each other. They may hate each other or they may cooperate, but people know each other. I remember that one of my first trips to the Balkans was to a village, and this was decades ago now, in the mountains, the middle of nowhere, where you could really get a sense of how human beings always used to be before the me generation and the modern kind of Osla that we have of not knowing who your neighbour is and old people dying in their beds and not being discovered for years and the other increasing horrors of our fragmented modernity. This was a little village in central Bosnia that actually taught me a lot because in my modern London upbringing I hadn't really seen or experienced anything like it. It was like a trip to the Middle Ages. One took this astonishingly slow train from Sarajevo to Zenica, and then a remarkably creaky bus up into the hills. And this was in the middle of winter. It was really cold, and there were these dark forests with trees covered in snow everywhere until we got to this little village. And the village was kind of an ordinary Bosnian village. But as I say, it taught me so much about how human beings really flourish and why we're so dysfunctional in our technically enabled modernity. In those days, you could tell a man's religion by the shape of his house. This is a tradition in Bosnia, and the Muslim house is always square and white. And this was a Muslim village, so all the houses are square and white. And in this house, everybody was, it was kind of extended family, would sleep together in a single room. So there's no seclusion in this village. And you had to develop certain social skills in order to get along with people in whose room you would be for most of your indoor life. So there'd be the old people, the toothless granny sort of smiling next to the stove and making complicated kinds of bread, and there'd be babies yelling all in this room. And then at night everybody would sleep and there would be these kind of amazing thick eiderdowns, which are like carpets. They would be heavy, but you'd need them because it was minus 25 outside. And that always, if you wake up, you'd see somebody putting logs on the fire in the middle of the night. You needed that. That's why we were all together in a single room. And if you needed the bathroom in the night, oh my God, you would have, by the light of the fire, to go to the door, put on your coat, put on your boots, and go through this yard. And I knew there were two cows in the yard, and you could bump into the cows and you'd feel them breathing on you until you got to the outhouse. And then you realized, the water was frozen in the outhouse, so you'd have to go back again to get the water. And it was a kind of primordial thing. People must have lived that way in those mountains for thousands of years. It was really a form of time travel. And then Fajr, and the men would go to the mosque, and the mosque was colder than a deep freeze. And outside the mosque, along comes the farmer who's the muezzin with a hammer. The hammer is so he can break the ice on the water trough so we can all do our wudu from this water. All of these pink-faced jolly peasants standing around in their bare feet on the ice, I didn't appreciate that too much. But it was an interesting insight into a community that was really of the fitra. They didn't really need the outside world. They produced their own food. They didn't have horses. They didn't produce their own clothes any longer. But it was interesting to see that they didn't have anything. There was one phone in the village and a few black and white televisions. You could watch sort of rather cheesy Yugoslav war dramas or violinists, but it was not interesting. Human beings were engaging with each other all the time. That was the richness of people's lives. That's why they smiled. And that's what was interesting in the village. The gossip, the scandals, religious stories, all of that. And it was profoundly healthy. I found it a very healing experience to be in that, to modern eyes, incredibly congested, claustrophobic, poor environment. Now, the Sharia and the Sunnah are for the fitrah and of the fitrah, as we said last time, and are for that environment. In our modern environment, and we need to remember this when we try and explain some of our principles, especially family principles, to the outside world, it's hard for us to envisage a world in which there's an extended family. In other words, a woman, if she's badly treated by her husband, the traditional assumption is that the woman's brother will come along and beat the husband up. And that still happens in traditional parts of the Muslim world. The assumption is it's families, extended families. When you get into the modern environment of atomized individuals and maybe single parent families and everything is very broken, a lot of those rules seem harder to understand. A lot of the inheritance rules, the witnessing rules. We need to understand this, and the ijtihad has to be on that basis. The sunnah is there as the precious reminder of how we should live as fitri human beings. But we may find that as people have been enculturated into modernity, there's certain things that we find it harder to understand. But it's still there to protect us, and it's still about common sense and what's normal. Look at this Me Too movement that has gone viral in America recently. All of those women, quite rightly, who've been harassed and abused, standing up and asking for justice and calling those men, usually men, to account. And you see the absurdity of the modern liberal individualism in that situation. The teenage girl who goes for an interview in Harvey Weinstein's hotel room at the Waldorf Astoria late at night. And the modern liberal thing would say, she's equal, of course, equal, they're equal. Well, yes, equal. But that's not the only thing that can be said about that situation. Where's the brother? Where's the mahram? Where's the father? And as a result, the society really is torn between, on the one hand, the desire for individualism, and on the other hand, the reality of Bani Adam and how we actually are and what actually works. And the sunnah, the sharia, even if we find certain things patriarchal, is still there to protect us, and we should always have respect for it and see what it has to offer. So we're in a profoundly individualistic and therefore dysfunctional environment where solitude is not something that people will occasionally savour. The shepherd in the hills got away from the village for a while, not listening to the old lady's gossip any longer, and he can decompress up on the mountainside. But loneliness, which is the modern plague, likely to get worse. And with the growth of automation, which is likely to progress after the end of the corona crisis, it's going to get worse. The gossip in the shop is less likely because you're ordering things online, or you're just paying a robot that barks out instructions to you in an inhuman voice, and that human contact has been lost. And one by one, the traditional forms of human sociality are being confiscated by modernity, basically because it's cheaper to find digital alternatives. So there's different types of loneliness, of this wahsha, this tawahush. There is, and psychologists talk about social loneliness. In other words, you haven't got people around you. You might be in an American supermax and banging your head against the wall after 10 years. But there's also emotional loneliness, which is another problem in our society, that even if you're with people a lot, there may not be a very good bonding with those people. It may be formulaic. And a classic example of this is the Royal Navy sea captain, who is a figure of such awe that the other officers in the ship, and certainly the ratings, can't really be friendly with him because he's the captain. That's the loneliness of command. And sometimes rulers experience that. They say some of the Ottoman sultans were very lonely people. There's also family loneliness, which is particularly acute, and the one that actually leads to the larger number of biomedical negative outcomes. And as we increasingly forget even the names of our cousins, let alone stay in regular touch with them, this is more and more common. We might also say, from an Islamic perspective, that we'd want to add a fourth category, which we might call natural loneliness. And by this I mean that if you're in the Bosnian village, you see that people have an engagement with other human consciousnesses, but also an engagement with animals. In this village where everything was so richly experienced, every field would have a name, every corner of the woods would be associated in the local mind with a particular event, you'd know where to get the mushrooms. They profoundly inhabited the land, something that has largely been denied us. That also all of the animals would have names, sometimes quite comical names. It wasn't just cows called Daisy, but it was sort of amusing. And people had a real relationship with animals, which is part of pre-modern normalcy. Even the hunter and the prey have a certain understanding, and he empathizes with the prey and what it's likely to do next and where it's likely to be found in the forest. Traditional life is about sociality, is about engaging with human ummas, but also the animal ummas. We saw this last time, that creatures are defined Quranically as ummamun amthalukum, nations like yourselves. And our engagement with them is particularly important. We know that the Holy Prophet sallallahu alaihi wasallam, in those extraordinary hadiths, had ways of communicating with animals. And Sayyidina Dawood had this facility as well. And that's a kind of mysterious thing, but it's something real. An animal is clearly a sentient being, which is why in Sharia it has rights. So that's another thing that we've lost. And so the National Health Service has a big pet therapy, animal-assisted therapy, they call it. And it's well known that the presence of animals is very beneficial in certain cases of anxiety and depression. Again, unless you've got sort of a cat to stroke in the evening, which isn't really the same thing as grazing sheep. That's another form of sociality that has driven us into our modern state of extreme loneliness. Now, an interesting aspect of this, when you think about it, is that human life actually begins in a state of seclusion. So if you think about what Imam al-Haddad calls the lives of man, first of all, we are with all of humanity, we're with everybody, the big jama'ah, at the day of Alastu bi Rabbikum, am I not your Lord? And we all say, it's the first person plural, Bala Shahidna, yes, we bear witness, not as individuals, citizens, but as Bani Adam. We all say that together. And then we're separated out into the Arham. The angel breathes the ruh into the fetus in that unimaginable process. And then the fetus is alone. Although there is a particularly profound relationship with the mother. We need to think about this as well. There's so much in our heritage about how to treat mothers, how to honor mothers, what to feed mothers with. Motherhood is one of the great signs of Allah, which is why Surat Maryam is this sort of astoundingly beautiful celebration of woman in her quintessence. And this miracle that she alone experiences of the insufflation of the spirit within her is the introduction of a new soul, infinitely precious, that to which the angels can bow down within this qararin makin. And the Quran speaks quite a lot of embryology and the stages of the development of the fetus, and then this insufflation, this breathing in of the spirit, this humanizing moment. But then a fetus is alone. Unless, of course, there's a twin. And this is another of the great mysteries that remind us of how profoundly we need each other. In the case of twins, it's very often in a very intensified form. Identical twins in particular, and everybody has strange stories that they've heard of twins. I know a woman who went into labor and her unmarried sister was woken up in the middle of the night by contractions. Other people, a girl I know in Cambridge who converted to Islam, called her identical twin, who was in America at the time, and said, "Guess what? There's this thing called Islam, and I've just taken something called my Shahada." And the identical twin had also taken her Shahada. Lots of stories like that. And this is not particularly from Sharia or from our doctrine. It's just from kind of human folk wisdom almost, just part of the experience of living in bodies as human beings. And there is a particular bond between two fetuses, two souls in the womb, three if it's triplets, which is a particularly profound thing, which should indicate to us that siblinghood is important. And the fact that siblings are so often driven apart in modernity is another tragedy, another aspect of human richness that is being lost. The Turkish language does this very nicely. A sibling, a brother or a sister in Turkish is kardeş, which means somebody who has shared a womb with you. It's a very beautiful way of talking about a sibling. It's a very profound concept. And a pregnant woman is called iki canlı, which means two-souled, because you know, she's this miraculous, revered phenomenon in Allah's creation that contains within herself not just one ruh, but two. I guess she's three-souled if it's twins. So this also indicates that even before we enter the world and start getting brought up, hopefully by caring parents and engaging with society, in that osla there can also be an engagement, and that this is a subtle and a spiritual thing that needs respected. فَاتَّقُوا اللَّهَ الَّذِي تَسَأَلُونَ بِهِ وَالْأَرْحَامِ. Fear God, concerning whom you question each other, and the wombs, most fundamental tie, the family, the basic unit of society, the family, the basic unit of sociality is the family, and our religion stands or falls on that. The Holy Prophet, sallallahu alaihi wasallam, was a family man. So we've made this distinction so far, and hopefully this clears up some confusion between seclusion and loneliness. We now need to think about the religious dimensions of seclusion. Loneliness is just a bad thing. Has nothing positive about it, really, except in certain other religious traditions, but not in ours. We might look at this, the idea of sacred loneliness, as being a blessing, but that's not an Islamic concept. So seclusion can have certain benefits. Unlike loneliness, it can even have medical benefits. It's seen to enhance cognitive ability under certain circumstances and the memory. Now, remember what I was trying to say last time about Islam coming in this reparative way to restore the principle of love, human love for each other, human love for God, at a time when things have become very austere and ascetical and punitive and dry, laden with guilt, particularly in the Western tradition. Islam comes along, and the earlier dispensation, the dispensation of Sayyidina Isa alayhi salam, al-Masih, had moved in the direction of this rahbaniya, this monasticism, and some quite acute forms of asceticism. The neglect of the body. People like St. Simeon, if you go to Orthodox churches today, very likely you'll see an icon or an image of St. Simeon, sitting on his Syrian column right at the top. He spent 39 years on top of a column, eating, sleeping, mainly praying there, in order to be in a state of seclusion and away from the temptations of the world, away from women, away from fitna. And there were thousands upon thousands of people who were doing similar things like that in that era. The idea of the skit, for instance, that is to say a kind of monastery where the monks live individually in little huts and come together maybe once a week, you can still see that in the Wadi Natron, originally the Skitos Valley, which is to the north of Cairo. There's still hundreds of monks there living in caves and little huts, hermitages. And this is one of the things that Islam did not continue. And does not really approve. St. Simeon on his pillar, even spending a year standing on one leg, according to the historians, tying himself up so that he wouldn't fall off in the night and the rope bit into his flesh, which rotted away. And he was happy when he saw the worms eating the flesh. And when the worms would drop off, he would pick them up and put them back into the womb, saying, return to your dinner. And really revered these sacred athletes, were at the heart of Christian piety for so long. So let me just give you a bit of Tennyson. A friend of mine yesterday said that I mustn't neglect Tennyson. He has a poem on St. Simeon. This is part of it. Let this avail, just dreadful, mighty God, this not be all in vain, that thrice 10 years, thrice multiplied by superhuman pangs, in hungers and in thirsts, fevers and cold, in coughs, aches, stitches, ulcerous throes and cramps, a sign betwixt the meadow and the cloud, patient on this tall pillar I have borne, rain, wind, frost, heat, hail, damp and sleet and snow. Well, that's a kind of heroic piety, get to God by self-torture. But this is not our way. And one of the blessings that the new Ishmaelite dispensation brought was that that was swept away. The Islamic historians say that the origins of monasticism were when the Romans were persecuting the early Christians, the Romans being pagan at the time, and they fled into the hills. And this is a sunnah in Islam as well, particularly in the end times. And they fled to hermitages. So we find Abu Bakr as-Siddiq saying to his army when they were going into Syria, "You will find people who have shut themselves up in cells. Leave them alone, because it's for the sake of Allah that they have shut themselves up." And generally, we find the Salaf and the early Muslims treating these people with very considerable respect. We know that the Holy Prophet treated Bahira the monk with very considerable respect, and that's an important moment in the recognition of his future prophecy in the Seerah. And if you've been watching Cambridge Mosque's Ramadan TV, you may have seen the documentary on the Blessed Tree, and you see the ruined monastic cell. It's still there and it's next to the tree. It's a very extraordinary place to visit. And the early Muslims encountered these people and were quite amazed by them. So one of the Salaf said, this is an English translation, "I met a rahib once." Rahib is a monk, one of these anchorites, and asked him, "Do you never fear being alone? Are you not afraid of solitude?" And he replied, "If you had tasted the delight of solitude, you would long for it away from yourself. Solitude is the beginning of the worship of God. What is the first thing you find in solitude? Peace far from human interaction and safety far from those evils which accompany it. When may the servant taste the bliss of intimacy with God? When his love for God becomes pure and he communes with him with a sincere heart. When is his love pure? When all his desires are concentrated in one, to obey God." Lots of stories in early Islam about the Tabi'in and others, people like Abu Sulaiman ad-Darani, Sahl al-Tustari and others, engaging with the Zuhad. And we find in the Quran even these people who are choosing sacred solitude mentioned. Where the Christians are praised, it says, "Dhalika bi anna fihim قِسِّيسِينَ وَرُهْبَانًا وَأَنَّهُمْ لَا يَسْتَكْبِرُونَ. That is because there are amongst them priests and monks, and because they are not proud. And then the verse وَرَهْبَانِيَّةً إِبْتَدَعُوهَا مَا كَتَبْنَاهَا عَلَيْهِمْ إِلَّا ابْتِغَاءَ رِضْوَانِ اللَّهِ فَمَا رَعَوْهَا حَقَّ رِعَايَتِهَا. And monasticism, that they invented, we did not prescribe it upon them, but seeking the pleasure of God, but they did not uphold it correctly. So what we would say then, looking at those early spiritual athletes, and they still exist. If you go to Mount Athos in Greece, which until 1912 was part of the Ottoman Empire, and that period actually in many ways was the flourishing of Athos. Republican Greece has tended not to treat it so well. 20 monasteries at its heyday, maybe 15,000 monks, huge population like cities. In this whole area, which is a peninsula of Greece, quite a large area, no women are allowed, no female animals are allowed. Until 1932, you could have hens, and so egg with your breakfast. And then the stricter monks decided that this was outrageous as well, and so they killed all the female hens, and it's hardcore monasticism. And there's different forms of it, but it's an interesting insight into the kind of extreme penitential attitudes that characterized early Christianity. If you wanted to get to God, you mortified the flesh, you wore a hair shirt, you flagellated, and perhaps you went alone into the wilderness. I was once with a group of Christian pilgrims in Palestine, and we visited a monastery on the road between Jerusalem and Jericho, Ariha. And of course, it's a very stressed and tormented landscape. So you see the wells that are only allowed to be used by the Israeli settlers, and the nice roads for the Israelis, and the miserable roads for the Palestinians, which includes the local Christians. And it's a very, for a serene holy land, it's appalling the way it's been scratched and violated. It's a tragedy, but the monastic thing gets away from that. So St. George's Wadi Kelt, you have to walk to it down a valley. There's a little stream. You can see rock hyraxes in the hills. It's a real desert. And the monks welcomed us, although they thought all of these Western Christians were outrageous heretics, and they told them that at one point. And we were shown into the chapel, and very proudly they showed us the body of one of their brothers, a Romanian monk, who had died 5 years earlier, a young man, and they just dug him up and put his body in the chancel of the church with a kind of cloth over him. But you can see his sneakers sticking up at the end. And they were going to render him down and put his bones in the ossuary, and the skull would be on the shelf with all of the other skulls. And the monastery has been there since before the rise of Islam. Muslims never touched it. They hardly noticed the rise of Islam. And the monks took us out and pointed up to the cliff, saying, we have anchorites here as well. The really serious, hardcore monks, when they're young, they go up into one of those caves, and they stay there for the rest of their life. They might be there for 50, 60, 70 years. They hoist up a basket of food every day. When it comes down untouched, they know that the guy has died. They send up a successor, and the body is then rendered down, and the skull goes on the shelf. So that still goes on. And in Mount Athos, it still goes on. And the early Muslims were seeing this. And this is really what the Quran is saying when it says, فَمَا رَعَوْهَا حَقَّ رِعَايَتِهَا. They didn't maintain it correctly. This is too extreme. The normative, paradisal, blessed human state is Eden, a place of plenty and a place of companionship. It's not some kind of eternal cave. But this is the view that they took. St. Augustine, when he had his conversion, immediately dropped his girlfriend and his child, and that was normal for the time. So the difference then is there can be a sacred seclusion, but there can also be a kind of cultivation of the torment of loneliness, which is perverse. Simone Weil, who was this very strange but brilliant thinker of the mid-20th century, said the extreme greatness of Christianity lies in the fact that it does not seek a supernatural remedy for suffering, but a supernatural use for it. In other words, the pain, the torment, the scratching of the soul caused by just terrible loneliness breaks you and hence opens you up to the transcendent. Now, Islam doesn't appreciate that. The Islamic way is very different. So if we've still got time, let's get some of the barakat of the seerah and the sunnah. And the amazing thing about these stories is that you can listen to them a billion times and they're always new. Right at the beginning of Sahih al-Bukhari, أول ما بدأ به رسول الله صلى الله عليه وسلم من الوحي الرؤيا الصالحة في النوم. And then حبب إليه الخلاء. This is a Ramadan story, of course. Before the Holy Prophet became a prophet, solitude, seclusion, was made beloved to him. وكان يخلو بغار حراء. And he used to go into solitude, into retreat, the cave of the Mount Hira. فَيَتَحَنَّثُ فِيهِ He would engage in تَحَنُّث. Now that's a strange word and may even be Syriac in its origin. So Imam al-Bukhari or the narrator says in explanation, وَهُوَ التَّعَبُّدُ اللَّيَالِيَ ذَوَاتِ الْعَدَدِ It means to worship for a specific number of nights. It's تَحَنُّث, solitary, in the cave, in this kind of monk-like devotion, قبل أن ينزع إلى أهله ويتزود لذلك before he'd go back to his family and take provision for a single similar period of time. حتى جاءه الحق وهو في غار حراء until the truth, capital T, came to him when he was in the cave of حراء. فجاءه الملك فقال اقرأ and the angel came to him and said, recite. قال ما أنا بقارئ He said, I am not a reciter or I'm not a reader. قال فأخذني فغطني حتى بلغ مني الجهل جهد So he took me and squeezed me until I came to the end of my endurance. ثم أرسلني Then he let me go. فقال اقرأ And said, read or recite. قلت ما أنا بقارئ I said, I'm not a reader, a reciter. فأخذني And this happens three times. And then the third time we get the first words of the miracle of God's book. اقرأ باسم ربك الذي خلق خلق الإنسان من علق اقرأ وربك الأكرم Surah 96, isn't it? Recite, in the name of your Lord who created man from a clot of blood. Recite, and your Lord is the most generous. That's not the end. فرجع بها رسول الله صلى الله عليه وسلم يرجف فؤاده The Holy Prophet went back with them, with the verses, and his heart was palpitating. فدخل على خديجة بنت خويلد رضي الله عنها. So he came in upon Khadija, his wife, and said, زميلوني زميلوني, cover me up, cover me up. So he's been covered in this blanket, this cape, whatever it is. حتى ذهب عنه الروع. Okay, and then we know the story that Khadija then reassures him, confirms him, she's the first believer, and takes him to her uncle, Waraqa bin Nawfal, in order to find out more about this angelic visitation. So here we see a difference. What is the difference? He is in his cave and experiences this extraordinary experience, and then goes to his family. The seclusion is not permanent. The khalwa is not eternal. The monk just dies in the cave. Whether he's experienced God or whether he's gone mad, both are said to happen, dies in the cave, the skull is put on the shelf. In the Islamic way, the new way, he goes to Khadija and she helps him, she consoles him, she does what a wife does for her husband, she supports him, radiallahu anha. So a difference is coming right at the beginning of this new dispensation. Something more cheerful, God is bringing something new that affirms family, that affirms gender, that affirms womanhood, that affirms life, life itself, and hence the principle of mahabba, this love that we're going to talk about a bit more in the next session, inshallah. Another thought. A few weeks ago, we marked the commemoration of Al-Isra wal-Mi'raj, the probably culminating event of the Holy Prophet's career, the night journey and the ascension. Now, one thing that nobody ever talks about in that is that when does it begin and when does it end? The first great moment, the Iqra, shattering the experience of the devil, of the angel. And then the Isra wal Mi'raj, this next culmination. The night before, he's been invited to spend the night with his cousin, Umm Hanit. Muslims call her Umm Hanit. She's Fakhita bint Abu Talib, and her husband is Hubayra, so he's staying in their family. So she is bint Abi Talib, so she's Imam Ali's sister, so she's kinswoman, close relation, a cousin. Stay at my place, stay with my family, she says. So he spends the first part of his night with Umm Hani's family, following her invitation. Then he goes out in the middle of the night to the Hijr, sleeps next to the Kaaba, and then it happens. Goes to Jerusalem, there's the Buraq, and then Sidrat al-Muntaha, فَكَانَ قَابَ قَوْسَيْنِ أَوْ أَدْنَى, and then the return, having led all of the Anbiya in prayer in that wonderful, affirming, inclusive Ishmaelite moment. And then he comes back, and that's usually where we stop the story, but the Sira writers go on. He goes back after that shattering experience, the most important experience in human prophetic history. He's been in the sight of God. مَازَغَ الْبَصَرُ وَمَا تَغَى. His eye did not swerve. The angels couldn't go there. He then goes back to the house of Umm Hanit, and he tells her what's happened. Some of the Sira writers aren't even clear that she's a Muslim by that point, but she dies a Muslimah. And she says, don't tell anybody about this because they already laugh at you. Now, this is still in the Meccan period and everybody's persecuting them and laughing at Abu Talib's orphan. And he gets up and he says, I'm going to tell them. And she pulls at his garment, but he insists. So the point again with this little insight is that just as the story of the Bad al-Wahi, the beginning of the revelation, kind of leads to human engagement with family, Khadija, the wife, the first believer, so also the Mi'raj begins and ends also with family, the extended family, the cousin, Abu Talib's daughter, Umm Hanit, the female cousin, family, life. And this is the meaning of what he says, and this has to be our last point. When he's at the extraordinary moment of the Mi'raj, and the angel offers him two chalices, one of wine and one of milk. And he chooses the milk. And the angel says to him, Hudita lil fitra, you've been guided to the fitra. Now, it's fairly clear that the symbolism here is that, of course, the wine in the chalice represents the sacramental traditions of Christianity, the Eucharist. The milk is of nature. Wine has been denatured, fermented, turned into something that is not itself through the process of fermentation, which is a kind of corruption, really, liquid corruption. Yeah. Although in some earlier sharia, wine was permissible. For us, paradigmatically not. The Holy Prophet chooses the milk, which is from nature directly, therefore from the fitra. And so this is a sign, it seems, that he is to be the one who brings the religion of nature, that affirms nature and a natural sociality. His engagement with animals, his engagement with women, his status as a parent, fully embedded in the reality of life and enjoying the sociality of human life, which is a beautiful thing and part of healthy human existence. So that's one of the amazing things that you can learn when you look at these Sira stories again, and you notice something, well, that's interesting. And particularly against the backdrop of this hugely punitive war on the body that Christianity had launched by that time. Better, more human, more humanistic, more humane, more life-affirming, less guilt-ridden. You can't really escape the body. There has to be a legitimate outlet for desire. Eve was not created to be pushed away. The garden is a sign of Allah's gift, and try and make the world a garden. The garden will be your place of return. So yes, better. Better than the Rahbaniyya, even though we always protected them, as we protected the monks of Mount Athos and St. Catherine's and all of those places for so many centuries, but we didn't follow them. So to get back to the point that we raised at the beginning, yes to seclusion, but the seclusion leads back to family. Imam Ghazali goes back to his wife when he's done the purgation that was necessary for him. Imam Abdul Ghani Nablusi returns to family life and becomes a very sociable person after his years of seclusion. And the Holy Prophet, sallallahu alaihi wasallam, after his great times of seclusion in the wilderness, returns to his family, does not stay in the wilderness. And this balance, yes to seclusion sometimes, sometimes there's i'tikaf, but we go back to our families, no to loneliness, and therefore no really to the age of loneliness, which, as George Monbiot points out, is a good way of characterizing our fractured and tragic modern reality. We see again the blessing of this Sharia and its applicability and appropriateness to our circumstances. And again, to pick up on something I was trying to say last time, we need to change our modality as Muslims in the West from being grumblers to being healers. And I have a chapter in my new book, which is about that, Western Muslims, from complainants to therapists. Instead of endlessly grumbling about we want halal meat in the prisons and we want this and we want you to stop Islamophobia and give us this, give us that, and being beggars really for these things, we need to see how we can heal society. What can we do about the people who die abandoned by their families alone? What can we do about the children who arrive hungry at school every morning? What can we do about all of those single parents, all of the spiraling rates of anxiety, depression, mental illness in the society? People are hurting. Instead of getting judgmental and just blaming everybody and feeling superior, which is not really a proper, humble religious response, let's see what we can do to help. And this Sharia that we have, this Sunnah that we have, is exactly crafted to recreate sociality, because we know Yadullahi ma'al jama'a, Allah's hand is with the congregation. This is a religion of standing shoulder to shoulder. We can't do that at the moment, but inshallah, it will happen again. And we need to be presenting the Sunnah to our neighbors as a kind of medicine chest, a set of remedies, rather than something that makes us engage in special pleading. Please tolerate our identity or something like that. No, we should be prouder and more confident. So alhamdulillah, we've moved through this territory, and I've done it in quite a historical way to indicate, you know, one reason why Islam was necessary and why it came as a kind of wave of love and a pushing away of something that by that time was very kind of punitive, guilt-inducing, unhappy, caused, I think, a lot of human unhappiness, and in some ways even tried to do that. So, inshallah, as we move through the month of Ramadan, and we're in the third of Ramadan, which is about maghfirah, we ask Allah's forgiveness at this time, and inshallah, we'll also be thinking about how to lose some of the excess pounds in the other sense. We're losing some weight physically, inshallah, but we need to lose that fat that is in our bank balances. And Ramadan's always the best time of year to do that. And the Holy Prophet was at his most generous, like the free wind, as the hadith said, in Ramadan, we give and give. And it's the thing that you spend money on that you tend not to regret. You can regret buying your new phone or car or whatever, but people tend not to regret money that they've given for a good cause. So inshallah, we know the CMC community, and our friends, brothers, sisters will be generous, and our staff have been very generous with their time this time. So inshallah, give generously to CMC, our little institution, inshallah, with a big heart, and help us to carry on. Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullah wa barakatuh.